turn from a life, and go at once into a classroom situation or a library for study. What returning souls do not do is immediately reincarnate into another life. For the newly discarnate soul, by far the most common deviation from the standard three primary stops is an immediate assignment to a place of energy restoration. There are souls who require emergency treatment to restore their damaged energy as soon as possible. While most initial meetings and orientation with guides involve some sort of on-the-spot rejuvenation of energy, this healing process has many alternative procedures in the spirit world. Sometimes a client who has just crossed over will tell you their weakened soul energy is in a strange-looking space. For instance, they could tell you they are in a geometric or crystalline enclosure that seems to be assisting them in healing and balancing their energy. They might comment about the need to fine-tune their vibrational levels with the help of these surroundings, and that they need solitude before rejoining their spirit group. They don't wish to mentally communicate with anyone for a while. It would seem after some lives, souls must have a sanctuary for quiet reflection before they can face any other activities. Clients do say, however, that guides monitor their progress. Clients often discuss crystals as a symbol of rejuvenation. Be prepared to hear from your client that these spaces of energy healing appear to resemble glass-like prisms or multifaceted walls reflecting colored lights all around them. Such spaces may function as vibrational generators to recharge the natural energies of the soul through a universal healing energy. Occasionally, I will place a quartz crystal into the hand of a client who is trying to articulate what is going on, because I believe the crystal can serve as a conductor of thought patterns between us. In life, as well as life between lives, the benefits of solitude provide a time for self-evaluation and inspiration through personal energy restoration. During life, we can become so distracted by the roles we play that we never learn who we really are. After a particularly difficult life, we suddenly find ourselves lacking the body that bonded us to all the challenging circumstances we faced. One can imagine the necessity for a time of quietude before a soul proceeds further into the spirit world to engage with other spirits. In Destiny of Souls, under Chapter 4, Spiritual Energy Restoration, I discuss the varieties of energy healing depending upon the condition of the returning soul. This list would include three general categories. A. The standard treatment before orientation for large numbers of souls. B. Emergency treatment for souls whose energy has been damaged by a violent death. C. Special treatment and recovery areas designed for souls who have been severely contaminated throughout an entire lifetime. I want to emphasize the fact that your client is not going to be disposed to giving you many details about their recovery areas after a tormented life. Unless I feel there is direct relevance today, I don't push them to do so because this experience is not something they must relive and dwell on to make our session a success. My therapeutic philosophy here is the same as I have expressed earlier under desensitizing trauma. Perhaps blocked memories of energy restoration and recovery after former lives involves protective amnesia by our guides. On rare occasions when I do hear about radically damaged souls, these reports are often given to me by third parties who knew such souls, or by a specialist soul in rehabilitation training. Drastic remodeling or reshaping of soul energy from a badly contaminated spirit may result in the soul never returning to Earth again. If a severe remodeling procedure was ever used on your client after a former life, it is being blocked as an act of kindness. I think it is best not to interfere. Orientation with guides. Since almost all your cases will involve some sort of orientation with a guide, you should be aware of the diverse aspects of this primary stop in the spirit world. I have spoken about the profound sense of awe your client feels in hypnosis at their first visual contact with their guide. These feelings become more verbal when the soul moves from the gateway with their guide to a space where acclimatization and past life review take place. I think it would be helpful for the LBL therapist to re-examine what I have to say about orientation and guides comprising chapters 5 and 8 in Journey of Souls. I discuss such matters as spiritual settings and the roles of senior and junior guides. This data will be pertinent to many of your cases. While the nuances of each case are different, you will find many similarities. For instance, at the initial contact with their guide, a devout Christian client might exclaim, "Oh, I see Jesus." A variation of this theme could be a statement to the effect of, "An angel has just come to meet me." There are clients with firm theological convictions who tend to believe their session is a religious rather than a spiritual experience. Thus, conscious preconceptions toward religious doctrine are manifested here. I try to be careful with the sensibilities of clients in this regard and generally say, "That's fine, but let's get a little closer so we can have a better look at this figure." They soon realize this preeminent being is their own personal teacher who has been assigned to them from their beginnings, rather than a great prophet from one of the world's major religions. It is no wonder some people call personal guides guardian angels. These floating beings don't have wings, but sometimes the halo of bright white light around them gives this impression. Once your clients are on their way to an orientation, many will report that their guides wear robes and display a head with distinctive facial features and gender characteristics they did not see before. The place of orientation is usually designed around some sort of comfortable and familiar earth setting. Quite often my subjects report being in a garden, where they are sitting on a white marble bench, talking to their teacher. This setting could also be in a familiar room of some sort, with a table and chairs, an area of open ground, or even an airy place composed of clouds. You have already reviewed the client's most immediate past life and are aware of the circumstances surrounding goals that were and were not achieved. Thus, you may be able to assist with their memories of assimilation back into the spirit world. Orientation is a place of mental healing, and it is possible you can learn much about your subject's current attitudes and conflicts in life by gently acting as a third party in these discussions between a soul and their guide. I will review how you can use the spirit world's now-time reality as current therapy later in this text. The following is a series of questions I typically pose to clients during orientation that may prove useful. 1. While you are talking to your guide, do you review what goals you established in advance of your past life? If so, how many of these goals were met? 2. Relative to these goals, could you tell me what was your greatest achievement and greatest disappointment in your past life? 3. How would you compare your last few lives with all those you lived before in terms of your continuing development? 4. Tell me about your guide's role in helping you before, during, and after your lives. 5. Does your guide offer any opinions about your overall advancement during this orientation? 6. What advice are you being given at this stage of your journey home? 7. Can you explain what other matters of importance to you transpire at this conference? Orientation is a time when clients begin to gain deeper insights about themselves. Thus, it is a good idea to try and relate your questions to what is going on in their current life. You will find that in these spiritual surroundings, souls are quite honest about their shortcomings. Self-criticism runs high during orientation after a life is completed. While guides have differing styles, I find most operate around the premise, "Don't be so hard on yourself. You did very well." As someone who has listened to thousands of guide-directed orientations, I can tell you they are never rigid or controlling. You will have the overall sense of empathic listening from guides because they already know everything about their soul client. Nothing can be hidden, and the soul knows this absolutely. It is my belief that guides are assigned to each soul because they have some particular affinity toward the strengths and weaknesses in the immortal character of that soul. It is almost as if the teacher's character is similar to their student, or that they struggled at one time with the same tasks. The love our guides feel for us is overpowering, and during our lives, often what we think is intuition or instinct is actually our guide trying to tell us something. After an LBL session, your client may explain that they now realize certain symbolic messages were left for them in earlier stages of their life to bring greater personal awareness and get them in focus. It is true that all guides are different. Some appear to be hands-on teachers who mentally assist us out of the deep holes we fall into during life, while others are more distant in their approach and seem to be removed from our lives unless we call on them out of desperation in a crisis. While your client talks about being frustrated at not accomplishing what they set out to do in their immediate past life, you may see the relationship to certain challenges in their current life. I try to concentrate on gaining broad information about the soul I am working with at this stage, rather than focusing on too many specifics. From what I have discovered, orientation is not supposed to be an intense period of soul questioning by a guide, but rather a gentle counseling and debriefing session. The deeper analysis involving the soul's perceptions and behavior in the life just completed normally becomes more evident later on in the spirit world. There are periods during a long LBL session when your persistence in questioning the client is advantageous, but the time of orientation is not one of them. If your encouragement to elicit more facts is not productive, be aware that the most meaningful period for psychotherapy is usually when you take your client before their counsel. Of course, there is always the issue of privacy and feelings by some clients, that they should not be revealing sacred aspects of their soul experience. It is peculiar, but I see more manifestations of a guarded attitude during orientation than I do at other junctures in the LBL session. Over the years, I have come to some conclusions about this phenomenon. It is true that orientation is the first one-on-one opportunity for the soul to unload their impressions about the last incarnation with a teacher. However, some souls may not be completely ready just yet because they need to unwind. There are other factors that might cause a client to be reticent about speaking freely at this stage. Aside from privacy issues, I think it has more to do with a lack of full comprehension. Since the orientation stop is early in their progression into the spirit world after death, the soul still has strong attachments to the organic body they have just left. Vestiges of their biological temperament and personality from that body do remain for a while after a life. This happens despite the fact the newly arrived soul is now in possession of their immortal character. Because of these factors, soul memories from orientation may initially cause even more confusion in the mind of a client reporting to you from a whole new biological state, that of their current body. It takes a while to work through the transformation your client will experience into a deeper, more pure soul state between lives. As the session progresses, you will see that the whole psychological reality of spiritual life becomes more literal and graphic for the subject. If you are patient with your therapeutic approaches during orientation, it will pay dividends later when your subjects fully see themselves as spiritual beings. Since orientation is intended to be an overview for the returning soul, often spirit time may seem rather short to them. Clients frequently say they don't remember all the details about their last orientation, and perhaps they are not supposed to remember too much of this experience in their current body. Thus, for many reasons, the average client will not mind your desire to get them moving on to the next station when orientation information dries up. At the appropriate moment, I ask, "Is it time to move to your next stop?" With an inadequate response, I might be more specific. "Do you think it is time to rejoin your friends?" Usually the answer is yes. As hypnosis facilitators, we do exert a great deal of control over the design and pace of a session. In fact, your subject unconsciously seeks your direction. However, I must warn you that your clients will have preferences for some spiritual images over others. For therapeutic reasons, I may feel at a particular point in the session I should ask, "For your own mental well-being, is there a particular place where you want us to move right now in the spirit world that would be of great benefit?" They may or may not agree to follow your suggestion. Just because you think a certain spiritual scene is appropriate to introduce at the moment does not mean that your subject will concur. They might want to visit other areas of the spirit world first before going someplace you suggest. Moreover, there are clients who will not visualize the same spiritual scenes that are typical of the majority of your other clients. Always use the subject's own directional compass when it is intact. Your clients may wish to revisit places in their spiritual memory that directly bear upon what they require today and will be able to guide you rather than the reverse. If you encounter any resistance to move at a certain stage in spiritual regression, you might simply ask, "Is there more you want to continue examining at the moment, or are you ready to travel with me to another area?" Always be flexible and open in your planning while encouraging constant feedback. Be prepared for a great deal of silence from your subject while they are mentally processing. I believe that people receive quantities of spiritual information that is not revealed to you by the spoken word. After a certain amount of effort on your part, you must accept these gaps. It will be quite evident on the audio tapes during replaying. An LBL session is truly a client-therapist partnership. The longer you work in this field, the more you will feel spiritually guided toward the best course of action. As I have said, for some souls, the period right after orientation may be an appropriate time for reflection, solitude, or a visit to the spiritual library for private study. After a difficult life, soul healing often occurs in quiet places, away from groups of companion souls and even our spiritual masters. In Destiny of Souls, I have gone into considerable detail about the Library of Life books. If your client indicates they are going to some sort of spiritual library in response to an inquiry involving solitude or study, I suggest the following series of questions. 1. Are you conducted to the library by your guide, or do you go alone? 2. How does this area of study appear to you during your approach? 3. Describe your entry into this space and tell me if you see other souls nearby. 4. Is there an advanced spiritual being, such as an archivist, in charge of this area? 5. Tell me what you see around you at this moment. 6. Do you feel this is going to be a time of life review? 7. Will you be reading something written in a book, looking at still pictures, or viewing a movie screen of some sort? 8. Now, begin your work, and tell me if you find yourself reading or watching pictures as an observer, or do you enter into a scene to actually participate in past events? 9. What are you learning or experiencing that relates to your current life? As you and your client move from place to place in the spirit world, it is always wise to suggest that they call upon their guide to assist with directions and the rate of soul transition. With an indecisive client, rather than directing the client to another stop of your choosing too quickly, perhaps the client just needs to hear, "What is it you want to do at this particular moment?" Part 5. Life Between Lives. Returning clients to their soul group. This last stop for the average incoming soul is particularly enjoyable. Through hypnosis, the client is given the opportunity to visit those soul companions who are close to them. Synchronicity always plays a part in LBL hypnotherapy. The client may need to have contact with a particular soul at the time of their session with you. After the incoming soul's first sighting of their friends, who are gathered in some sort of cluster grouping, I find guides make themselves scarce. They seem to be hovering nearby at this stage, and yet many people report that they are going in solo, even during the last portions of this journey. Nevertheless, souls do not express discomfort or feel abandoned by their guides. During the final stages of the trip home, you must be prepared for a variety of reports from different clients. Some subjects will describe beautiful open fields and countryside settings where their companions are waiting. Others see structures such as temples, libraries, or schoolhouses. Transitions to these places vary between clients and between their lives. In Journey of Souls, Chapter 6, Under Transition, I describe the memories of souls who reported traveling toward great central hubs of activity before moving into more quiet zones where they saw transparent bubbles containing clusters of souls off in the distance. In Destiny of Souls, Chapter 5, Under Community Centers, I wrote about a common visual occurrence with clients who see a great recreational hall full of soul groups, one of which belongs to the incoming soul. Chapter 5 has case descriptions about this meeting hall composed of secondary groups of up to 1,000 souls. The client's primary group in the hall averages from 10 to 20 souls. Why is it that some clients find their soulmates in open countryside scenes as opposed to spaces involving a structure of some sort? Why do some incoming souls see many soul groups conversing together in community halls, while others are aware of only a few friends gathered to meet them? This is not something we can know absolutely, but over many years I have drawn some conclusions. We might logically begin by assuming that the time of departure from Earth right after death would influence a soul's point of reentry into a continuing sequence of spiritual activities. I do know that the same souls can have different reentry experiences after each past life. A more subtle meaning pertaining to different visualizations of spiritual settings at reentry could have a symbolic relationship to the life just completed. They may directly relate to character traits of the soul, as well as the temporary personality acquired in the life just lived. The question you must ask yourself is, what is it that this soul requires most to integrate back into the spirit world? A therapist should consider both the personal identity and life history of their client. There is also the issue of what current beliefs are held by your client that might be influencing their visualizations. The soul's developmental level ought to be taken into account as well. When I examine the symbolic significance of certain scenes, I can say that souls who have just crossed over will relate their earthly experiences in the life just completed to spiritual encounters that seem familiar. I believe that metaphorical comparisons in which an idea or picture is applied to offer a certain meaning can even be orchestrated by guides. When the mind is trying to process interpretations of spiritual images, it may construct metaphors to make the information more palatable to physical reality. Regardless of the arrival surroundings, always consider what function the scene represents to the soul. Here are some examples. A. Gardens represent spaces of security and peace, combined with gentle counseling by guides. B. Temples, including community halls, represent spaces of spiritual communion with others. C. Schoolhouses and classrooms represent areas associated with soul group learning exercises and teachers. D. Libraries are quiet spaces designed for personal study and individual reflection. E. Primary soul group enclosures are places the incoming soul associates with the privacy of a home and family interaction. Sooner or later in the session, but most commonly right after orientation, the time will be suitable for you to bring your client forward to the space where they are able to see all their soul companions. They could take you there without prompting, or you might have to ask, "Is it time to rejoin your friends?" Usually, you will hear soul group descriptions that indicate a kind of space within a space where these soul companions are gathered. This area, not in a recreational hall, is considered a spiritual haven. Particularly with the younger souls, a transparent enclosure may actually represent a boundary separate from other cluster groups. Throughout this stage of connecting with members of their soul groups, clients respond well to questions about feeling certain soul vibrational levels. The individual and collective vibrational frequency of companion souls increases as the client approaches their soul group, where there are mutual feelings of joyous expectation. Identification of soulmates. Before going further with soul identification within a cluster group, It is a good idea to recognize the three major categories of souls in our immortal lives. A. Primary soulmates. Frequently, but not always, this soul is a deeply bonded partner, such as a spouse. This soul could also be a brother, sister, best friend, and even a parent on rare occasions. B. Companion soulmates. These are the souls within a cluster group who make up our spiritual family. Normally, these souls are siblings, children, and good friends as participants in our physical life. C. Affiliated souls. These are all the souls who make up secondary groups of souls located around our own primary cluster. They often incarnate as parents as well as protagonists to teach us certain karmic lessons. Typically, they are acquaintances in life who are associated with us for a reason. However, many of the souls in nearby groups are unknown to us both in life and the spirit world. There are practical variations within these three general categories of souls. For instance, it is quite possible for a client to have only a brief association with a soul in life who is actually a soul companion in their soul group and not an affiliated soul. The reasons for this may have karmic significance relating to a former life. As you bring your subject closer to the area where they see the light energy forms of a soul gathering, their responses often become rather halting. Under the topic of pacing, I have mentioned the importance of moving slowly at certain periods in the session. Soul identification is one of those intervals where you must allow your client plenty of time to respond to questions. When a subject says to me, "I'm coming from a distance away and I can't make out what I am seeing," my acknowledgement would be, "You are doing fine. Take your time and move closer. Just be patient, and everything will soon come into focus for you." As your client draws closer, they will say something to the effect of, "I see points of lights together." These visualizations are similar to their reports about lights during the crossing phase of the session. I generally respond with three basic questions. 1. Tell me what you see them doing. A standard reply would be, "I think they are waiting for me." My next question is one requiring a closer examination. 2. How are they arranged in front of you? If the client does not respond or is unsure, I will follow up with a few choices. 3. Do you see these lights moving about singly, in pairs, or as one large cluster of brightness? Bringing subjects close to their soul group is also described in Destiny of Souls under Chapter 5, detailing two of the most common cluster group positions, the phalanx diamond and the half-circle position. Notice the positions of the returning soul in relation to their guide, who is behind them in these illustrations. As I have said, in most instances, your client's guide will not be next to the incoming soul. I have indicated that during this entire phase of returning souls to their groups, most guides tend to remain unobtrusive. In fact, souls don't seem to have the need to converse with their guides at all at this stage. Once the soul moves close to their cluster group during the recognition phase, many clients are only vaguely aware their guides are positioned somewhere around them. In other cases, you could have clients who recognize their guide standing in back or well to the side of a line of souls during the identification of individual cluster group members. You will realize this situation from those clients who remark, "One light is brighter and a different color from the rest." I think it would be helpful to offer a case example of my clock technique, which I find useful for soul group identification. The client in this case is named Susan. She is visualizing herself as a returning soul who has just encountered a semicircle of lights she knows are friends. Dr. N. As you move close to the lights of your friends, I want you to tell me how they are arranged in front of you, in a line, a circle, a half circle, or bunched up. Susan. In a kind of half circle. Dr. N. Good. Now count how many lights you see. Take your time and tell me how many there are. Susan. Pause. Oh, I see 9. Dr. N. And as you come toward them, are you positioned in the center, on the left, or on the right of these 9 lights? Susan, more confidently. In the center. Dr. N. Okay. Now, in order to help me, just imagine that all these souls are located around you like the numbers on the face of a clock. You are in the center, where the hands of the clock would be placed. Thus, the light directly in front of you is at 12 o'clock, the one on your far left is at 9 o'clock, and the light on your far right is at 3 o'clock. As you draw closer, if a light should move behind you, it would be at 6 o'clock. The rest of your friends can be anywhere in between. Do you understand? Susan.
Yes.
Dr. N. Good. Now tell me from what position on our clock does the first soul move toward you? Susan.
Oh, in front, at 12 o'clock.
Dr. N. Is this being a male or female appearing figure? Susan.
Male.
Dr. N. Who is this person in the life you just left? Susan.
My husband, Jim.
Note, if this is an emotional reunion, I will stop to give my client time to embrace this person and report whatever she wishes about the communication between them. Dr. N. And who is this person in your life today? Susan.
My God, it's my husband, Bill.
Dr. N. What is Bill's immortal spiritual name? Susan.
Shamo.
Dr. N. And what is your own immortal name? What does Shamo call you? Note, you may have already asked for your client's spirit name earlier in the session, but if you have not done so, or you were unsuccessful, this is an opportune time to learn the name. Susan.
Lila. I am called Lila.
Dr. N. All right, Lila. What color does Shamo project to you? Susan.
Yellow and white.
Dr. N. If I were standing where Shamo is now and holding up a full-length mirror toward you, what colors would you be radiating? Susan.
The same colors.
By using soul names as early as possible in the session, you establish greater personal identification between the client and their soul. Also, they feel more connected with the action unfolding in their minds about the spirit world. Recognition of soul colors. I could have asked Susan simply, "What light color do you project?" However, I have found that the use of a pictorial approach, where the soul sees themselves symbolically in a reflecting mirror, allows for a more objective response when reporting on their personal color. Moreover, since clients will be visualizing some sort of soul group configuration with many colors, this should be reinforced with the client and diagrammed in your notes. Usually the client will see the positions of souls around them in a half circle. It makes it much easier for the client to see or feel their companions if you move around the circle, identifying each member of the group by name, color, and personal characteristics. If the souls are bunched up or in a diamond shape, you would simply identify those in front first and then move backward. Under the section in this text's First Contact with Spirits, Part 4, I mentioned that colors are generated by the specific energy vibrations of each soul. Souls display halo and core colors. The primary core color emanating from the center of the soul being constitutes the level of soul advancement, while the secondary color around the edges of the light, the halo, typically involves character traits. Core and halo colors may be different or the same. You might have a level 2 reddish-orange soul whose character represents intensity and passion. This soul would show one color. To give other illustrations of character, yellow is typically a persevering color of strength and courage, while green denotes healing, blue, knowledge, and purple, wisdom. With soul energy, one must be careful not to confuse client reports of bright gold colors with the basic yellow tones.
Many level 3 souls have a primary yellow color, which is often less vivid than bright gold. Highly advanced souls may display brilliant glittering gold, frequently as flecks mixed with the blues and purples. Gold presents a highly refined energy pattern, and yet it does represent similar characteristics to yellow in terms of protective strength and influence toward other, less advanced souls. It is a very powerful, active color. Because the light and dark blues and purples represent more advanced souls, I am frequently asked, what is the difference between knowledge and wisdom? The blues are mental and analytical souls who are very devoted to the details of cause and effect with regard to karma. Some blues are more detached in the realm of the spirit world and are committed to interdimensional travel. In this case, the blue is the level of advancement and may be mixed with silver, an ethereal color associated more with the individual nature of the soul. As for the highly evolved darker purple colors displayed by very senior guides and council members, we find knowledge that has transcended into wisdom that is broad and eclectic in scope, linked to experience and talent. All indications point to our council members as being responsible for our next body, and thus they must apply great wisdom and originality in problem-solving. The matching of soul character to a human brain is ingenious, or perhaps I should say, divine. Certainly both the darker blue and purple beings are highly principled, decisive, and organizational, yet they display great creativity and have infinite patience, forgiveness, and love. As an LBL facilitator, it is best to be cautious about inflexible rules connected with the meaning of soul colors. I have found that a very high percentage of clients agree that certain attributes do apply to particular colors and to the developmental stage of souls who display these colors. Even so, there are always exceptions, because energy vibrations are subtle and anomalies do occur. Moreover, we cannot always trust every client observer to be consistent with all the details in their accounts throughout the session. For the facilitator, it is prudent not to jump to conclusions about colors too quickly before cross-checking all your client reports. As I move my client around their group, I make notes of each soul position and ask, "What color do you see radiating from this soul?" Even though a soul is displaying more than one color during the group visualizations, the subject may just lump both into one dominant color without more serious consideration. More often than not, if only one central color is seen, especially from a distance, it usually represents the level of advancement. I also keep a record of the luminosity of each light. Does the soul display a steady, brilliant light of a high-energy soul, or is it dim and flickering, indicating a more passive or younger soul? These reports provide clues to a soul's attributes. Gathering information on a soul group. Collecting information on each soul member takes time because many subjects identify their soul companions slowly. You owe it to your client to give them all the time they require so no cluster group member is missed. This is why taking detailed notes is important. I start taking notes in the session from the moment we enter the client's past life, so I can always refer back to their previous statements for corroboration. As an example, I might comment, "When we approached your cluster group, you told me there were 10 souls, but now you only mentioned 9. Are we missing one soul?" If necessary, I will go further by adding, "I notice there are souls at 2 and 4 o'clock. Is someone at 3? It is very handy to have the client's typed sheet listing the cast of characters in their current life in front of you during this stage. Hopefully, your notes written down during intake about the social dynamics between family members will also be useful. As the client identifies each soul companion, usually there are 2 names, their earth name and the immortal name. As with the names of guides, sometimes the spiritual name can be difficult to pronounce. While the subject sounds out the name, just as I instructed them to do earlier with their guide, I ask them to also try and spell the names of each companion, which I then write down. If it is incomplete, I will say, "I'll just use what we have now. You can correct me if necessary as we go along." Corrections often come a short while later, after the client has heard me mispronounce the name a few times. This works particularly well with your subject's own immortal name. Primary soulmates. As your subject begins to identify each member of their soul group, invariably you will witness a highly emotional scene when they cite their primary soulmate. Frequently, this particular being is their first identification because it is common for a primary soul to come forward before anyone else. My previous books contain much information about soulmates. For purposes of this text, I want to touch on one therapeutic issue involving soulmates that can be most disturbing to your client should it arise at this point in the session. Anyone who has experienced a relationship with a great love in their life knows that the chemistry of a mental and physical reunion is capable of transforming the spirit. The essence of this conjoining energy is feeling that all at once part of yourself resides in another. Soulmates who are together make each other more complete with mutual validation. When it is right, the togetherness of true love transforms the old self into a stronger force than before. Incarnating to express themselves in physical form is one of the basic motivations for primary soulmates to come to Earth and meet. People worry that following the wrong person in life may cause them to miss their star. Nevertheless, this too is no accident. When your client visualizes coming together with their primary soulmate in the spirit world, it is one of the most joyful moments in their session with you. Even so, I want you to be prepared for those clients who will state in a depressed tone, "My soulmate is not with me in my current life." Perhaps they were never intended to be in this life, or maybe this person was an earlier love they lost. In these circumstances, only at best is your client's first reaction one of understanding and acceptance. More often than not, the client's initial impression is that they have been cheated. This is due to negative feedback from the conscious mind. Despite being in a superconscious state, a client in this frame of mind is suddenly overcome by feelings of a loss of support. They blame a less-than-satisfying life on the fact their primary soulmate is absent. Naturally, the impact here is even greater with the realization of how many past lives they have lived together. These memories are more potent when the client has already relived a past life earlier in the session, where they were mated to their primary soulmate. All souls have the power of choice in their lives, because without free will, our lessons would mean nothing. During an LBL session, while a client is emotionally rebonding with a primary soulmate who is not in their life today, I indicate that behind this absence lies some aspect of learning which they have chosen in advance. I want my client to process this information for themselves because self-discovery is always the best teaching tool. It is vital to listen and not get ahead of your client with your own interpretations while they are unraveling the meaning behind events. I gently remind clients that free will comes with a price, which is the right to make mistakes. And this is how we learn. When people ask me at public forums why they have never found their soulmate in life, I explain they may have done so, but for many reasons an opportunity might have been missed. I add that it is also possible they were not intended to be with their primary soulmate this time around. To illustrate this, I will cite the case of Catherine, who came to see me with the question, "Why can't I find my true love?" Catherine has had a difficult current life with poor relationships, starting with emotionally distant parents, two husbands who were not connected with her, and a series of men who did not work out for various reasons. Today she lives with an emotionally protective man who is also her business partner. They care for each other, but are not in love. During Catherine's session, we learned this man is a strong member of their soul group, but is not her primary soulmate. The two souls agreed to come together around the middle of their respective lives and work with each other. In Catherine's last life, she had a long, happy marriage with her primary soulmate from 1874 to 1927 in Savannah. They were inseparable for over 50 years, dying within a year of each other. It was a beautiful, quiet, and restful life without many outside challenges because they were given what is called a buy in that life due to two difficult previous lives where they were not together. Both asked for an easy life with each other and then received it. Catherine gained perspective into her life today when she discovered that after thousands of years of often being together with her primary soulmate, not always as a spouse, they had become too dependent upon one another and shut out other people. To work harder in meeting the challenges of life and advancing, they needed to be apart more often. When working with a client who is saddened because they are not with their primary soulmate, I think the LBL therapist should make it clear that people can have productive and enriching relationships with men and women who are not soulmates. I have found close, loving alliances do exist among companion souls from the same cluster group and also with souls from affiliated groups. They are working together for some mutually beneficial karmic purpose. When your client discovers all this was planned in advance, it eases the burden they feel to keep searching for the right person. I have a standard question to ask those clients who say they are with the wrong person or spent years with a very difficult or abusive individual earlier in life. What have you learned from this person that you would not otherwise have known had you never met them? I want to know if they are stronger and wiser for the experience. We are with people in life who have something to teach us, just as we do for them. The lessons are countless, involving such issues as jealousy, greed, arrogance, intolerance, and lack of compassion. Karma rests on our actions over the sum of many lives, not just one. For these lessons, our primary soulmate may assume the role of a blood relative or best friend. Sometimes your client may find that they have been in a love relationship with a primary soulmate for only a short time, to learn one specific lesson before being separated. Hopefully this aspect of your client's LBL session will allow them to come away with a better appreciation for the reasons behind their experiences. By the end of the session, most clients realize that life is not just a capricious jumble of unrelated events. The Inner Circle and Missing Soul Companions. As therapists, we must be mindful of interpersonal connections in the lives of clients with those people around them. Spiritual regression increases a client's perceptions about the meaning of having certain soul companions affect their lives, both positively and negatively. While you are working with your client in the identification of soul companions in a cluster group, you will be exposed to an inner circle. This designation is used to describe a smaller group of intimate companion souls who often incarnate as spouses, brothers, sisters, and best friends. They may also be aunts, uncles, and cousins. It is possible to find a parent, but this is uncommon because frequently our parents come from nearby affiliated groups. An inner circle usually consists of 3 to 5 souls who invariably assume lifetime roles close to each other. Sometimes prospective clients will ask you to schedule back-to-back sessions with themselves and their mates, siblings, and best friends. The keeping of detailed records is particularly valuable when two clients who know each other wish to compare their LBL sessions. It is true they have their tape recordings, but you will have made additional notes to yourself that are not on these audio recordings. Having your prior notes from the first client near you during a later session with a spouse, sibling, or friend is useful in asking relevant questions. These notes are confidential and for your use only. Regardless of the length of time between the two sessions, there will be occasions when one of these pairs of people sees a member of their inner circle and the other does not. This could cause distress, especially to a happily married couple. For instance, if Jane sees her husband John in her spirit group, but John does not see Jane when it is his turn, does that invalidate Jane's visualization? My answer is no, it does not. We might argue that possibly John's soul is more significant in Jane's life than the reverse, but in most cases this too is a wrong assumption. I believe that there are 3 major grounds for a disparity between hypnosis visualizations of 2 souls from the same group who are bonded in life. A. The timing of arrival into the group from a former life between the 2 souls is different. Using Jane and John as an example, when pressed further, John might say, "I don't see Jane right now because she is away and engaged in an activity, but I feel her presence." B. One soul may not wish to show themselves right away to another because of a difficult karmic issue between them in their last life together. I call this the hunkering down syndrome, where one soul hides behind another during the group identification process until a more appropriate period. In Destiny of Souls, Chapter 7, Case 47, I have a section on reuniting souls who have hurt each other. This involves a father and son case that characterizes this situation. Remember that it does not matter if the soul of a parent has reincarnated again years before the arrival of their child in the spirit world, because a portion of their energy never left. Generational differences do not affect spiritual reunions because of this capacity for soul division. C. The differences between visualizations by two clients may be due to the nature of remaining energy from the effects of soul division. Soul energy. In the context of relationships between clients that are closely bonded with others on Earth who they want to see in the spirit world, the issue of soul division involving incarnated energy is an element to consider. In the example of John and Jane I just discussed, John may not see Jane because Jane displays only a faint light from her remaining energy in the spirit world. If a soul companion is not clear or is unseen during the initial soul group identification, it may be due to their dim light dormancy, a term used by subjects to explain a low percentage of rather inactive energy. The reasons for this could be that the soul required a great deal of their energy for a particularly difficult reincarnation, say 80%. So what light remains is faint. Dim light, not to be confused with younger souls, is particularly evident with souls who have chosen to live parallel lives in two bodies in the same timeline. This practice, designed to accelerate learning, is not encouraged by guides for the average soul because it causes such an energy drain. On the other hand, I have had clients that are not living parallel lives who decided to bring less energy, under 30%, into a host body because they were overconfident about their capacity to handle a life. Many of these clients felt a lack of energy in life without knowing why. Their motivations were to leave a greater percentage of energy in the spirit world to carry on their work there more vigorously. This remaining energy would thus appear brighter in the spirit world. There are people who make themselves less effective on Earth because of this decision. The average soul takes around 50 to 70% of their energy into a body. This can vary from life to life, depending on a soul's body choices and state of advancement. What would happen if a soul were permitted to bring too much energy into a body? One client answered that question in this way. Too much incarnated energy, like in the 90-plus percent range, would overload the brain, making it non-functional. 100% would blow the circuits. In terms of soul division, I should add, it appears that once a decision is made to take a given amount of energy to Earth, souls are not able to retrieve more during their lifetime, regardless of how much they may need it. Besides the potential for human brain disruptions from a new and permanent energy surge, I don't think it would be physically possible for the human brain to tolerate a lasting transfer of new energy. It has been said that we are able to tap into our entire spiritual energy during times of stress through prayer or meditation. When an LBL facilitator assists the client in connecting with all their energy in a superconscious state, it may seem as though there is a transfusion of new energy. You will notice a reaction of energy unification with some clients as they experience an awareness of their whole being. However, I have often been told that while in a physical body, the soul mind cannot simply withdraw from its reserves of energy in the spirit world and keep it. We live by our choices made between lives, just as we do during our incarnations. It is like being under a contract. The following perspective about connecting with his spiritual energy reserve came to me from Evan, a level 5 soul. There is a directly proportional relationship between my brain and the energy of my soul. This was established in the womb. It is true I can temporarily draw upon the energy I left in the spirit world if my energy has been depleted during a crisis. I can also work in reverse, sending portions of my energy from the spirit world into my body. This rejuvenation can occur during sleep, or if my body is under anesthetic or in a coma. The restriction which does exist is that energy boosting cannot be permanent, or would adversely alter my brainwaves into an unfamiliar state of being. At the least, it would create a personality disorder. At worst, insanity. Because I wish to know the delicate balance that exists between the energy of the soul and the brain, I often ask my clients questions about their incarnated energy. 1. What percentage of your total energy did you bring into your current body? 2. Do you think you brought enough to complete the goals you established for your body? 3. Are you able to tap into that portion of your energy which remains in the spirit world on a temporary basis from Earth? As an LBL facilitator, you have the opportunity to encourage clients to be more aware of their internal energy resources during times of emotional turmoil in life. Examining character types in groups. During your examination of a cluster group, there are standard questions that you will ask of all clients. Here are a few examples. 1. Of all the souls you see, who is in your life today? 2. Of the souls you have identified, who are the ones you have most often incarnated with in your past lives and why? 3. Starting with your primary soulmate, tell me the significant roles certain souls in your group most enjoy filling. 4. Identify the different character types within your inner circle of closest friends. 5. In your opinion, what is the general state of advancement of your group? Are you all advancing at about the same rate? Once the identification of souls in a primary group is completed, I may ask a couple of open-ended questions, such as, 6. What thoughts are you receiving from your group? 7. Is there anything meaningful going on right now between you and your group that you can tell me about? Perhaps there is a planned homecoming celebration or some other activity that I might miss if I did not allow the subject to fully explore their visualization of this scene. It is possible the client will open up new territory with, "I think I must go now to another place." This could mean a visit to their council for a life review, going to the library for study, participating in a classroom exercise, or engaging in some sort of recreational activity. If this happens, you will just have to follow your client's inclinations and bring them back to their group later if your investigations here are unfinished. If there is no urgency in leaving their cluster group, you could start a new line of inquiry along the following lines. 8. If I was a visitor to your group, what impression would I take away about all of you? 9. Why do you think you were all brought together to form this group in the beginning? 10. Is there a common denominator of talent, interest, and goals among you? Do you all aspire to specialize in the same area? Of course they don't, but this could generate an intriguing answer. Your client could start anywhere with such responses as, "A lot of us are healers. Most of us want to be teachers. We are pleasure-oriented and not very studious." These reports lead to other questions that will tell you more about the characteristics of your subject's immortal soul and how this being integrates with others in their group. Most groups do have certain common dispositions that bind them together because you can be sure there were reasons why a primary group was formed with these particular souls. In Journey of Souls, Chapter 7, I refer to the homogeneous aspects of a group's members, such as mutual interests and cognitive awareness. I hear that most souls in a cluster group seem to grow at about the same rate, but you are going to find there are the slower ones who will be the last to leave. However, be aware that most groups of companion souls are actually designed to have a mix of character differences. I outline this dichotomy in Chapter 9 of Journey of Souls. For instance, there are the courageous, tenacious survivors, quiet, more passive souls, calculating souls, and fun-loving, humorous souls. This system is planned so that each soul is capable of supporting others in their group during a lifetime. Each soul in the group lends its strength to another's shortcomings for balance. For example, on Earth, You could have two soulmates working together where the husband is over-analytical and cautious, while his wife is more emotional and a risk-taker. Due in part to the bodies they occupy, and in part to the soul energy of those bodies, the two souls complement one another. By comparing the character traits of your client's soul to the rest of the souls in their group, you help them understand what is behind the attitudes and social dynamics of their relationships with significant people in their lives today. It would also be advisable to check this information against the vibrational energy colors of individual members of the group for further contrasts. Collecting all this color data, including client reports about light density, provides you with further clues about the group regarding character, current relationships, and individual rates of growth, all of which can be of therapeutic value to your client. As you explore the cluster group, you will find a senior master teacher and quite often a junior guide or student teacher in training. They may be identified by your client right away, or this information may come from a question. Do you see someone in the vicinity directing your group? Frequently, a junior guide is left in charge while a senior guide is away. This being may still be incarnating from time to time, but nonetheless is still a teacher. As I mentioned earlier, you will have cases when after a former life your subject enters the spirit world and right away rejoins their friends in the middle of a classroom situation. I am always interested in group classroom assignments, such as energy creation training. The level of these assignments will also give you clues about the group's abilities and goals. It is possible the class will be involved with a psychodrama of certain past life performances by its members. This activity is instructive about the group's capabilities. I will review psychodrama by a group of souls further in Part 5 regarding other spirit world activities. I have stated in my books that despite all the differences between souls, no soul is looked down upon as having less value because they are not progressing as fast as others in the group. Everyone makes contributions, and all are in a process of transition. There are souls who want every life to be difficult, while others prefer many easy lives mixed into the lives involving greater effort. We are given choices. Because there is order and direction in the spirit world, where accomplishment is venerated, this does not mean the afterlife is a place of hierarchy with a rigid set of bureaucratic rules. Those are the trappings of our earthly societies. Souls are not forced to reincarnate at regular intervals and live demanding lives. Before each life, there are options, and souls feel no authoritarian pressure to succeed within certain earthly time frames. The desire to grow and develop in life after life comes from within ourselves. After you have finished your more specific questions about their primary group, I suggest you broaden your inquiries to include nearby groups. Of course, much depends on the level of responsiveness from the client up to this stage. If I am getting good results, I might continue with this question. Now that I know the many character differences between your soul companions, can you tell me if you are aware of a soul existing nearby in another group whose character is very similar to your